This program focuses initially on one piece. When we're devising these programs, we have different ways of doing them depending on the material. This one made sense to focus initially on one piece and let everything grow from that. And that one piece is a little chanson by Ochagen, Faut seulement l'attendre. It is a beautiful and widely distributed song in the 15th century. Sometimes we use the word popular to describe such songs, and I wonder if it's the right word. When we say popular today, if I say, what is a popular song today, we all know. It has to do with Billboard charts and gold records and things like that, downloads and the rest of it. What does it mean to say that a song was popular in the 15th century? I suspect we should probably reserve that word for tunes that every urchin on the street could whistle. I don't think Faut seulement was popular in that sense, but it was popular in a different way, and it's indicative of perhaps Ochagen's reputation or simply the amount that people liked this song. We are fortunate to have usually two copies of any given song from this period. Altogether, there are about 1,500 French-texted songs that survive from about 1415, 1420 to about 1480. 1,500, it's not a small number. Many of those, unfortunately, survive in just one copy. One imagines all you needed was one hungry rat or a misplaced bomb or a bad flood, and we wouldn't have it at all. That's pretty much the normal state of affairs. Occasionally, we'll have one that has three or four sources. And then very rarely, we have them, they survive in multiple sources. And Faut seulement is one of those songs. It pops up in a number of different sources, copied in a fairly wide region of Europe. And it's indicative, I suppose, that when a few years ago a new collection of songs appeared, new as in we didn't know about it, it was sitting in somebody's library, private library for 500 years, when this little manuscript popped up holding 50 songs, 12 of which are previously unknown, wouldn't you know it, Faut seulement, there it is. It gets to the point where we could kind of predict that if we were to find another such collection copied in France, more or less any time in the second half of the 15th century, whatever else is in there, Faut seulement, and a few other like it, songs like it, would be there. So, in that sense, yes, popular. Why choose one piece to organize a whole program around? Well, the fact of the matter is we could have organized three concerts around it and all done pieces based on Faut seulement. There are a number of works, a couple of them by Ochagen himself, but also works by other composers that take this chanson as the starting point. That might seem like an unusual thing. Ideas of creativity, originality, novelty that we widely hold today were shaped probably mostly in the 19th century. Prior to that, the idea that you begin a new something, a new painting, a new poem, a new piece of music, by starting with something that someone else had already done, would have seemed an entirely normal thing. Inventing a new tune seems to have had less of a priority than showing what you could do with that tune. In the case of Ochagen's song, it's a beautiful tune, I have to say. You'll hear it. It's the first thing on the program. It's an absolutely gorgeous little tune. And they sing it very beautifully. I heard them do it the other night. When other people take it, they want to do things with it. And they don't just take the tune and put it in the top part and then write things around it. Oh, no. They do all kinds of things with it. Ochagen himself does all kinds of things with it. He writes another chanson, in fact, called Faut seulement. It begins with the same two words, but then has a different text after that. That's also on the program tonight. And in that case, he took the top melody and drops it down into the bass. And makes it a bass line now with everything going on above it. Clever idea. He will also write a mass you'll be hearing the three surviving movements of this Mass tonight. We wish we had the other two, but what can you do? 500 years, things go missing. In that case, he uses the work in a number of ways, very clever, woven into very complex five-voice polyphony, something which, at the time this Mass was written, the Missa for Seulement, as it's called, was something still of a novelty, writing in five parts. Sometimes when I say this to people, they say, well, what's the big deal? Three parts, four parts, five parts, what's the difference? You just add on another line. How hard could it be? Well, I want you to imagine something. We tend to use visual metaphors in talking about low notes and high notes. I mean, it's a built-in metaphor. When we write them on paper, we low notes, high notes. If you were to imagine the space from the lowest note that they tended to use to the highest note that they tended to use in all this music that you've been listening to in these concerts, in all 15th century music, let's say it looks like that. And if you have three voices, well, you can split that cake into three layers, and nobody will get in anybody's way. Top voice will have a space to move around in, the middle voice will have a space to move around, and low voice will have a space to move around. Everybody's happy. Four voices, same cake. Cake doesn't get any bigger. Four slices now. Now everybody has to be a little more careful about where they move. If you go too high, suddenly you're going to be stepping on somebody else's territory. Five voices, they still don't expand the cake. It's the same, what we would call tonal space. And within it, you need to have now five layers. The other image that comes to mind is five lanes of traffic on a four-lane highway. You want whoever is guiding the traffic to know what they're doing. Fortunately for all of us, Ochagem is guiding the traffic in this piece. Even though he is masterful in his handling of such a complex texture, you will notice, I think, in the first two movements in particular, the Kyrie and Gloria of the Missa for Seulement, which will end the first half of the program, I think you will notice that it is some of the densest textured music that Blue Heron will do probably in this entire series of Ochagem concerts. The words wall of sound come to mind. But it's not a kind of undifferentiated mass of noise coming at you, far from it. The miracle of it, and I do see it a little bit as a miracle that it works, is he has written for five voices in a very contained space, often all five of them going simultaneously, and they're not imitating one another. You could write music like that. One voice begins, a second imitates the melody, a third imitates that, and so on. There's very little of that in this Missa for Seulement. To the contrary, a lot of it is what we call free imitation, free writing, free counterpoint. All five voices are simply following a certain course, a certain outline, a certain contour. That should be a recipe for disaster. Five people singing simultaneously music that is not directly related to one another, and how does it not end up sounding like a traffic jam? Therein lies the art. What we hear, or at least what I hear, when I listen to a piece like this, where Ochagem is in full voice mode, is something like a tapestry that somehow has diamonds woven into it that peek out from time to time. And your attention is taken first high and then low and then in the middle. That's not a sign of distraction. I think that's kind of how this music works. It actually, for all of the fullness of the texture, in this particular way, leaves a lot of room for the listener. You can choose which part of this thing you're going to listen to, in a way. If you think about it, there's some music, some wonderful music, that in fact works rather differently. It tells you, we're going to go here, and then we're going to go there, and no lingering, now we're going there, and then we're going there. That works too sometimes. But in a piece like this, we do have space for the listener. The listener chooses what to listen to. There are two other works on the first half of the program that take Faux Seulement as a starting point, and in this case, they are works by younger composers. The generation of composers born immediately after Ockeghem's generation included some of the major figures of Renaissance polyphony. And a number of them, it seems, viewed Ockeghem as a kind of lawgiver, if you will. It's not clear if any of them actually studied with him in any direct sense. It's possible. And very few of them seem to have frequently been willing to really emulate Ockeghem's style. I think it's a tightrope act to try and emulate Ockeghem, again, risks disaster. There's some people that you should admire but not try and imitate too closely. Every once in a while, one of them will, and it can be a very stunning effect. There is one guy, though, in this next generation who, if you could point out a successor to Ockeghem aesthetically, musically, is the likely composer of the fourth work on the program, Pierre de la Rue, who is a major figure at the Habsburg-Burgundian court. He's born around 1450. He is a composer of pretty dense stuff himself. He does not shy away from thick textures, low textures. There's a slight wildness about some of his music that reminds us of Ockeghem. This piece, which I give Scott full credit for unearthing, I mean, it was out there, but I didn't know it, and a lot of people, I think, hadn't paid any attention to it. And it could seem like a rather modest piece, but it's a gem. Maria Mater Grazia has a Latin text, but it also uses Faux Seulement, a combination of new material and old material. It is a hauntingly beautiful piece, and I'm delighted that Scott has found it and brought it to us. I think you will be delighted as well. The other work is a short work by Mateus Pipelar, another of these northern composers born of this generation. Here, there's the possibility, as Scott mentions in his excellent program notes, which if you haven't read them, you'll want to. I think they'll be very helpful. He mentions that Pipelar's piece could have been written for instruments. There's not a great deal of music in this period that we can say with great confidence was intended for instruments. No doubt a lot of it was done on instruments. For a rather long time, a lot of instrumental music will take vocal pieces as the starting point and then improvise on them. But there is a possibility that this piece by Pipelar, which again takes the tune of Faux Seulement as its basis, could have been one of these pieces. At the same time, as Scott notes, the text fits the music very well. You just can't quite do a full performance of a rondo form. It's slightly complicated in some ways, but you can actually underlay the poem in its most basic way. So they're doing it, and I think it's a nice idea, they're doing it as a vocal piece. If the whole first half of the program is based on a song by Ockeghem, the second half takes a different song, not by Ockeghem, as its starting point. There will be one movement of the Missa Faux Seulement of Ockeghem at the beginning of it, but after that, the last three pieces are works that are generated from the song that comes second on the second half, Je ne vis donc la pareille. This song, we don't really know exactly who wrote it. Trust me when I tell you I wish I did. The problem is a not uncommon one in the 15th century. Two people get credited with the song. And they happen to be the two most famous composers from the first half of the 15th century, Guillaume du Failly and Binchois. The song is one about which we know a surprising amount in terms of its likely first performance. And again, for details of that, you can look into Scott's program. Very briefly, it seems to have been composed, perhaps especially for a very big event held in 1454 at the court of Burgundy, when then Duke Philip of Good was thinking about maybe having a crusade to take back Constantinople, which had fallen to the Turk the year before. Nothing came of it, but they did enjoy themselves at this party. That much is true. It was a real blowout. And we know things about how this song was performed. If we consider simply geographical proximity to that event at the time, then Benchois would be the likelier composer. He was still, as it were, in the neighborhood and had only recently retired from the service of the Burgundian Duke himself. So a likely candidate. If they needed a special piece, who are you going to call? Well, Benchois would have been a likely candidate. Dufay, meanwhile, at that point, was rather far away from this part of northernmost France and what is now southern Belgium. Not impossible that he wrote it, but on the basis of geography alone, slightly less likely. If it is by Benchois, it is unlike other songs of his we have in certain ways. We're not sure what kind of music Benchois wrote in the last decade of his life. He dies in 1460. He's a generation older than Ochagen. And if you recall, on an earlier program in this series, Blue Heron performed a lament for Benchois that Ochagen had composed that suggested, at the very least, a deep affection and desire to pay homage to his older contemporary. This song, Je vis donc la pareille, is one of those songs that so easily could be transferred from the secular realm to the sacred. This happens with some frequency in the 15th century. A song, the text of which praises a lady without peer, beautiful above all, can very easily in the mind become the symbolic representation of Our Lady, Virgin Mary. This song, if you look at the text, in fact, makes that particular link especially clearly when the speaker, the lyric eye, says, I've never seen the equal of you, my gracious lady, for your beauty is upon my soul by all others unequaled. Upon seeing you, I marvel and ask, is this Our Lady, Notre Dame? In that case, the implication is clear. The connection between an idealized beloved and the Virgin Mary is made very, very explicit here. That could happen within a song, but it could especially happen if you take such a seeming love song and use it as the basis for a sacred piece of music, say a movement of a mass or a motet, a medium-length piece with a Latin text that's otherwise religious. We get both versions of that at the end of this program. Two works by composers of this younger generation who, Agricola and Gisela. Agricola's piece is one of the more virtuosic things overtly virtuosic things that Heron has done in recent years that I've heard. I won't spoil it for you, but trust me, it starts out kind of harmless enough, but pay attention, and you might want to buckle up somewhere. They really get going on this piece. He's notorious for this. He writes things that are wonderfully mad. I don't know how else to put it. He's not a composer that we pay as much attention to today as we should, but certainly given how popular his music was then, if we want to understand the late 15th century, we should probably get to know Agricola better. Finally, the Ghiselin piece. Ghiselin is a name that even people like me who spend a lot of time working on this kind of stuff, we don't pay much attention to Ghiselin. That's probably a mistake. I'll just point out one fact about Ghiselin that should give you some sense of his stature in his own time. One of the remarkable things that's always noted about the career of Ghiselin's very, very famous contemporary, Josquin des Prez, is that when a printer in Venice decided to issue the first printed volume devoted entirely to the music of one composer, he chose Josquin. And quite rightly, we should note this. This is a big moment in the history of music. But it's easily forgotten that who was the second guy to whom he devoted a volume solely of his music? Ghiselin, it turns out. So a printer in Venice would not have done that unless he thought he was going to sell many volumes. It was a huge risk financially, an enormous labor to do it. So it tells us something about Ghiselin's reputation, that he merited that. This little piece, and it's a smaller scale piece, this Salve Regina with which Scott has chosen to end the program, is another little gem. The famous Salve Regina chant is not only buried in the piece at various places, along with Je ne vis donc la pareille, the plain chant frequently surfaces and steps forward. It is an alternatim setting where you have part of the piece that sings, the singers will sing the plain chant, Salve Regina, unadorned, and then another section of it will be done in polyphony, back and forth. It's a very common way of doing Salve Reginas in the 15th century. And it does mean that the concert ends tonight with plain chant, not with polyphony. It's not only a beautiful way to end the concert, it's a very good reminder to all of us. All of these composers that we are listening to in this series, Ochagam and all of his contemporaries and followers, they were professional singers. They worked within the church, most of them, or within courtly chapels. And the music that they sang day in and day out was plain chant. We tend to pay a lot of attention to their polyphony, which we should. It's gorgeous. But we should also remember what they fed themselves on, and that was plain chant. It's always in the background of everything they do. And this last piece on the program tonight is a nice reminder of that. I hope you enjoy the concert. Thank you for your attention.